in 1,000 male high school students in Mississippi are openly gay. So it ain't just mobility. If a similar number of gay men are born in every state, and mobility cannot fully explain why some states have so many more openly gay men, the closet must be playing a big role. Which brings us back to Google, with which so many people have proved willing to share so much. Might there be a way to use porn searches to test how many gay men there really are in different states? Indeed there is. Countrywide, I estimate, using data from Google searches and Google AdWords, that about 5% of male porn searches are for gay male porn. These would include searches for such terms as Rocket Tube, a popular gay pornographic site, as well as quote-unquote gay porn. And how does this vary in different parts of the country? Overall, there are more gay porn searches in tolerant states compared to intolerant states. This makes sense, given that some gay men move out of intolerant places into tolerant places, but the differences are not nearly as large as the differences suggested by either surveys or Facebook. In Mississippi, I estimate that 4.8% of male porn searches are for gay porn, far higher than the number suggested by either surveys or Facebook, and reasonably close to the 5.2% of pornography searches that are for gay porn in Rhode Island. So how many American men are gay? This measure of pornography searches by men, roughly 5%, are same-sex, seems a reasonable estimate of the true size of the gay population in the United States. And there is another, less straightforward way to get at this number. It requires some data science. We could utilize the relationship between tolerance and the openly gay population. Bear with me a bit here. My preliminary research indicates that in a given state, every 20 percentage points of support for gay marriage means about 1.5 times as many men from that state will identify openly as gay on Facebook. Based on this, we can estimate how many men born in a hypothetically fully tolerant place, where, say, 100% of people supported gay marriage, would be openly gay. My estimate is about 5% would be, which fits the data from porn searches nicely. The closest we might have to growing up in a fully tolerant environment is high school boys in California's Bay Area. About 4% of them are openly gay on Facebook. That seems in line with my calculation. I should note that I have not yet been able to come up with an estimate of same-sex attraction for women. The pornography numbers are less useful here, since far fewer women watch pornography, making the sample less representative. And of those who do, even women who are primarily attracted to men in real life seem to enjoy viewing lesbian porn. Fully 20% of videos watched by women on Pornhub are lesbian. 5% of American men being gay is an estimate, of course. Some men are bisexual. Some, especially when young, are not sure what they are. Obviously, you can't count this as precisely as you might the number of people who vote or attend a movie. But one consequence of my estimate is clear. An awful lot of men in the United States, particularly in intolerant states, are still in the closet. They don't reveal their sexual preferences on Facebook, they don't admit it on surveys, and in many cases, they may even be married to women. It turns out that wives suspect their husbands of being gay rather frequently. They demonstrate that suspicion in the surprisingly common autocomplete, "Is my husband gay?" Gay is 10% more likely to complete searches that begin, "Is my husband?" than the second place word, "cheating." It is 8 times more common than an alcoholic and 10 times more common than depressed. Most tellingly, perhaps, searches questioning a husband's sexuality are far more prevalent in the least tolerant regions. The states with the highest percentage of women asking this question are South Carolina and Louisiana. In fact, in 21 of the 25 states where this question is most frequently asked, support for gay marriage is lower than the national average. Google and porn sites aren't the only useful data resources when it comes to men's sexuality. There is more evidence available in big data on what it means to live in the closet. I analyzed ads on Craigslist for males looking for casual encounters. The percentage of these ads that are seeking casual encounters with men tends to be larger in less tolerant states. Among the states with the highest percentages are Kentucky, Louisiana, and Alabama. And for even more of a glimpse into the closet, Let's return to Google search data and get a little more granular. One of the most common searches made immediately before or after gay porn is gay test. These tests presume to tell men whether or not they are homosexual, and searches for a gay test are about twice as prevalent in the least tolerant states. What does it mean to go back and forth between searching for gay porn and searching for gay test? Presumably, it suggests a fairly confused, if not tortured, mind. It's reasonable to suspect that some of these men are hoping to confirm that their interest in gay porn does not actually mean they're gay. The Google search data does not allow us to see a particular user's search history over time. However, in 2006, AOL released a sample of their user searches to academic researchers. Here are some of one anonymous user's searches over a 6-day period. Friday 3:49, 55 seconds. Free gay pics. Friday 3:59, 37 seconds. Locker room gay pics. Friday 4 o'clock, 14 seconds, gay pics. Friday 4 o'clock, 35 seconds, gay sex pics. Friday 5:08, 23 seconds, a long gay quiz. Friday 5:10, a good gay test. Friday 5:25, 7 seconds, gay tests for a confused man. Friday 5:26, 38 seconds, gay tests. Friday 5:27, 22 seconds, am I gay tests. Friday 5:29, 18 seconds, gay pics. Friday 5:30, 1 second, naked men pics. Friday 5:32, 27 seconds, free nude men pics. Friday 5:38, 19 seconds, hot gay sex pics. Friday 5:41, 34 seconds, hot man butt sex. Wednesday 13:37, 37 seconds, am I gay tests. Wednesday 13:41, 20 seconds, gay tests. Wednesday 13:47, 49 seconds, hot man butt sex. Wednesday 13:50, 31 seconds, free gay sex video. This certainly reads like a man who is not comfortable with his sexuality, and the Google data tells us there are still many men like him. Most of them, in fact, live in states that are less tolerant of same-sex relationships. For an even closer look at the people behind these numbers, I asked a psychiatrist in Mississippi who specializes in helping closeted gay men if any of his patients might want to talk to me. One man reached out. He told me he was a retired professor in his 60s and married to the same woman for more than 40 years. About 10 years ago, overwhelmed with stress, he saw the psychiatrist and finally acknowledged his sexuality. He has always known he was attracted to men, he says, but thought that this was universal and something that all men just hid. Shortly after beginning therapy, he had his first and only gay sexual encounter with a student of his who was in his late 20s, an experience he describes as wonderful. He and his wife do not have sex. He says that he would feel guilty ever ending his marriage or openly dating a man. He regrets virtually every one of his major life decisions. The retired professor and his wife will go another night without romantic love, without sex. Despite enormous progress, the persistence of intolerance will cause millions of other Americans to do the same. You may not be shocked to learn that 5% of men are gay and that many remain in the closet. There have been times when most people would have been shocked, and there are still places where many people would be shocked as well. In Iran, we don't have homosexuals like in your country, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, then president of Iran, insisted in 2007. In Iran, we do not have this phenomenon. Likewise, Anatoly Pakhomov, mayor of Sochi, Russia, shortly before his city hosted the 2014 Winter Olympics, said of gay people, "We do not have them in our city." Yet internet behavior reveals significant interest in gay porn in Sochi and Iran. This raises an obvious question. Are there any common sexual interests in the United States today that are still considered shocking? It depends what you consider common and how easily shocked you are. Most of the top searches on Pornhub are not surprising. They include terms like teen, threesome, and blowjob for men, phrases like passionate lovemaking, nipple sucking, and man-eating pussy for women. Leaving the mainstream, Pornhub data does tell us about some fetishes that you might not have ever guessed existed. There are women who search for anal apples and humping stuffed animals. There are men who search for snot fetish and nude crucifixion. But these searches are rare, only about 10 every month, even on this huge porn site. Another related point that becomes quite clear when reviewing Pornhub data, there's someone out there for everyone. Women, not surprisingly, often search for tall guys, dark guys, and handsome guys, but they also sometimes search for short guys, pale guys, and ugly guys. There are women who search for disabled guys, chubby guy with small dick, and fat ugly old man. Men frequently search for thin women, women with big tits, and women with blonde hair, but they also sometimes search for fat women, women with tiny tits, and women with green hair. There are men who search for bald women, midget women, and women with no nipples. This data can be cheering for those who are not tall, dark, and handsome, or thin, big-breasted, and blonde. I think this data also has implications for one's optimal dating strategy. Clearly, one should put oneself out there, get rejected a lot, and not take rejection personally. This process will allow you eventually to find the mate who is most attracted to someone like you. Again, no matter what you look like, these people exist. Trust me. What about other searches that are both common and surprising? Among the 150 most common searches by men, the most surprising for me are the incestuous ones I discussed in the chapter on Freud. Other little discussed objects of men's desire are shemales, 77th most common search, and granny, 110th most common search. Overall, about 1.4% of men's Pornhub searches are for women with penises, about 0.6%, 0.4% for men under the age of 34 are for the elderly. Only 1 in 24,000 Pornhub searches by men are explicitly for preteens. That may have something to do with the fact that Pornhub, for obvious reasons, bans all forms of child pornography, and possessing it is illegal. Among the top Pornhub searches by women is a genre of pornography that, I warn you, will disturb many readers: sex featuring violence against women. Fully 25% of female searches for straight porn emphasize the pain and/or humiliation of the woman. Painful anal crying, public disgrace, and extreme brutal gangbang, for example. 5% look for non-consensual sex, rape, or forced sex, even though these videos are banned on Pornhub. And search rates for all these terms are at least twice as common among women than men. If there is a genre of porn in which violence is perpetrated against a woman, my analysis of the data shows that it almost always appeals disproportionately to women. Of course, when trying to come to terms with this, it is really important to remember that there is a difference between fantasy and real life. Yes, of the minority of women who visit Pornhub, there is a subset who search, unsuccessfully, for rape imagery. To state the obvious, this does not mean women want to be raped in real life, and it certainly doesn't make rape any less horrific a crime. What the porn data does tell us is that sometimes people have fantasies they wish they didn't have, and which they may never mention to others. Closets are not just repositories of fantasies. When it comes to sex, people keep many secrets about how much they are having, for example. In the introduction, I noted that Americans report using far more condoms than are sold every year. You might therefore think this means they are just saying they use condoms more often during sex than they actually do. The evidence suggests they also exaggerate how frequently they are having sex to begin with. About 11% of women between the ages of 15 and 44 say they are sexually active, not currently pregnant, and not using contraception. Even with relatively conservative assumptions about how many times they are having sex, scientists would expect 10% of them to become pregnant every month. But this would already be more than the total number of pregnancies in the United States, which is 1 in 113 women of childbearing age. In our sex-obsessed culture, it can be hard to admit that you're just not having that much. But if you're looking for understanding or advice, you have once again an incentive to tell Google. On Google, there are 16 times more complaints about a spouse not wanting sex than about a married partner not being willing to talk. There are 5.5 times more complaints about an unmarried partner not wanting sex than an unmarried partner refusing to text back. And Google searches suggest a surprising culprit for many of these sexless relationships. There are twice as many complaints that a boyfriend won't have sex than that a girlfriend won't have sex. By far, the number one search complaint about a boyfriend is, "My boyfriend won't have sex with me." Google searches are not broken down by gender, but since the previous analysis said that 95% of men are straight, we can guess that not too many boyfriend searches are coming from men. How should we interpret this? Does this really imply that boyfriends withhold sex more than girlfriends? Not necessarily. As mentioned earlier, Google searches can be biased in favor of stuff people are uptight talking about. Men may feel more comfortable telling their friends about their girlfriend's lack of sexual interest than women are telling their friends about their boyfriends. Still, even if the Google data does not imply that boyfriends are really twice as likely to avoid sex as girlfriends, it does suggest that boyfriends avoiding sex is more common than people let on. Google data also suggests a reason people may be avoiding sex so frequently: enormous anxiety, with much of it misplaced. Start with men's anxieties. It isn't news that men worry about how well endowed they are, but the degree of this worry is rather profound. Men Google more questions about their sexual organ than any other body part, more than about their lungs, liver, feet, ears, nose, throat, and brain combined. Men conduct more searches for how to make their penises bigger than how to tune a guitar, make an omelet, or change a tire. Men's top Googled concern about steroids isn't whether they may damage their health, but whether taking them might diminish the size of their penis. Men's top Googled question related to how their body or mind would change as they aged was whether their penis would get smaller. Side note, one of the more common questions for Google regarding men's genitalia is, "How big is my penis?" That men turn to Google rather than a ruler with this question is, in my opinion, a quintessential expression of our digital era. I wanted to call the book that inspired this audiobook, "How Big Is My Penis? What Google Searches Teach Us About Human Nature," but my editor warned me that would be a tough sell, that people might be too embarrassed to buy a book with that title in an airport bookstore. Do you agree? Do women care about penis size? Rarely, according to Google searches. For every search women make about a partner's phallus, men make roughly 170 searches about their own. True, on the rare occasions women do express concerns about a partner's penis, it is frequently about its size, but not necessarily that it's small. More than 40% of complaints about a partner's penis size say that it's too big. Pain is the most Googled word used in searches with the phrase blank during sex. Bleeding, peeing, crying, and farting round out the top five. Yet only 1% of men's searches looking to change their penis size are seeking information on how to make it smaller. Men's second most common sex question is how to make their sexual encounters longer. Once again, the insecurities of men do not appear to match the concerns of women. There are roughly the same number of searches asking how to make a boyfriend climax more quickly as climax more slowly. In fact, the most common concern women have related to a boyfriend's orgasm isn't about when it happened, but why it isn't happening at all. We don't often talk about body image issues when it comes to men, and while it's true that overall interest in personal appearance skews female, it's not as lopsided as stereotypes would suggest. According to my analysis of Google AdWords, which measures the websites people visit, interest in beauty and fitness is 42% male, weight loss is 33% male, and cosmetic surgery is 39% male. Among all searches with how-to related to breasts, about 20% ask how to get rid of man breasts. But even if the number of men who lack confidence in their bodies is higher than most people would think, women still outpace them when it comes to insecurity about how they look. So what can this digital truth serum reveal about women's self-doubt? Every year in the United States, there are more than 7 million searches looking into breast implants. Official statistics tell us that about 300,000 women go through with the procedure annually. Women also show a great deal of insecurity about their behinds, although many women have recently flip-flopped on what it is they don't like about them. In 2004, in some parts of the United States, the most common search regarding changing one's butt was how to make it smaller. The desire to make one's bottom bigger was overwhelmingly concentrated in areas with large black populations. Beginning in 2010, however, the desire for bigger butts grew in the rest of the United States. This interest, if not the posterior distribution itself, has tripled in 4 years. In 2014, there were more searches asking how to make your butt bigger than smaller in every state. These days, for every 5 searches looking into breast implants in the United States, there is 1 looking into butt implants. Thank you, Kim Kardashian. Does women's growing preference for a larger bottom match men's preferences? Interestingly, yes. Big butt porn searches, which also used to be concentrated in black communities, have recently shot up in popularity throughout the United States. What else do men want in a woman's body? As mentioned earlier, and as most will find blindingly obvious, men show a preference for large breasts. About 12% of non-generic pornographic searches are looking for big breasts. This is nearly 20 times higher than the search volume for small breast porn. That said, it's not clear that this means men want women to get breast implants. About 3% of big breast porn searches explicitly say they want to see natural breasts. Google searches about one's wife and breast implants are evenly split between asking how to persuade her to get implants and perplexity as to why she wants them. Or consider the most common search about a girlfriend's breasts, "I love my girlfriend's boobs." It is not clear what men are hoping to find from Google when making this search. Women, like men, have questions about their genitals. In fact, they have nearly as many questions about their vaginas as men have about their penises. Women's worries about their vaginas are often health-related, but at least 30% of their questions take up other concerns. Women want to know how to shave it, tighten it, and make it taste better. A strikingly common concern, as touched upon earlier, is how to improve its odor. Women are most frequently concerned that their vaginas smell like fish, followed by vinegar, onions, ammonia, garlic, cheese, body odor, urine, bread, bleach, feces, sweat, metal, feet, garbage, and rotten meat. In general, men do not make many Google searches involving a partner's genitalia. Men make roughly the same number of searches about a girlfriend's vagina as women do about a boyfriend's penis. When men do search about a partner's vagina, it's usually to complain about what women worry about most, the odor. Mostly, men are trying to figure out how to tell a woman about a bad odor without hurting her feelings. Sometimes, however, men's questions about odor reveal their own insecurities. Men occasionally ask for ways to use the smell to detect cheating, if it smells like condoms, for example, or another man's semen. What should we make of all this secret insecurity? There is clearly some good news here. Google gives us legitimate reasons to worry less than we do. Many of our deepest fears about how our sexual partners perceive us are unjustified. Alone, at their computers, with no incentive to lie, partners reveal themselves to be fairly non-superficial and forgiving. In fact, we're all so busy judging our own bodies that there is little energy left over to judge other people's. There is also probably a connection between two of the big concerns revealed in the sexual searches on Google: lack of sex and an insecurity about one's sexual attractiveness and performance. Maybe these are related. Maybe if we worried less about sex, we'd have more of it. What else can Google searches tell us about sex? We can do a battle of the sexes to see who is most generous. Take all searches looking for ways to get better at performing oral sex on the opposite gender. Do men look for more tips or women? Who is more sexually generous, men or women? Women, duh. Adding up all the possibilities, I estimate the ratio is 2-1 in favor of women looking for advice on how to better perform oral sex on their partner. And when men do look for tips on how to give oral sex, they are frequently not looking for ways of pleasing another person. Men make as many searches looking for ways to perform oral sex on themselves as they do how to give a woman an orgasm. This is among my favorite facts in Google search data. The truth about hate and prejudice. Sex and romance are hardly the only topics cloaked in shame, and therefore, not the only topics about which people keep secrets. Many people are, for good reason, inclined to keep their prejudices to themselves. I suppose you could call it progress that many people today feel they will be judged if they admit they judge other people based on their ethnicity, sexual orientation, or religion. But many Americans still do. This is another section I warn readers that includes disturbing material. You can see this on Google, where users sometimes ask questions such as, "Why are black people rude?" or "Why are Jews evil?" On the enhancement, you'll find a chart showing in order the top 5 negative words used in searches about various groups. African Americans, number 1, rude, 2, racist, 3, stupid, 4, ugly, 5, lazy. Jews, number 1, evil, 2, racist, 3, ugly, 4, cheap, 5, greedy. Muslims, number 1, evil, 2, terrorists, 3, bad, 4, violent, 5, dangerous. Mexicans, number 1, racist, 2, stupid, 3, ugly, 4, lazy, 5, dumb. Asians, number 1, ugly, 2, racist, 3, annoying, 4, stupid, 5, cheap. Gays, number 1, evil, 2, wrong, 3, stupid, 4, annoying, 5, selfish. And finally, Christians, number 1, stupid, 2, crazy, 3, dumb, 4, delusional, 5, wrong. A few patterns among these stereotypes stand out. For example, African Americans are the only group that faces a rude stereotype. Nearly every group is a victim of a stupid stereotype. The only two that are not, Jews and Muslims. The evil stereotype is applied to Jews, Muslims, and gays, but not black people, Mexicans, Asians, and Christians. Muslims are the only group stereotyped as terrorists. When a Muslim American plays into this stereotype, the response can be instantaneous and vicious. Google search data can give us a minute-by-minute peek into such eruptions of hate-fueled rage. Consider what happened shortly after the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, on December 2, 2015. That morning, Rizwan Farooq and Tashfeen Malik entered a meeting of Farooq's co-workers armed with semi-automatic pistols and semi-automatic rifles and murdered 14 people. That evening, literally minutes after the media first reported one of the shooter's Muslim-sounding name, a disturbing number of Californians had decided what they wanted to do with Muslims. Kill them. The top Google search in California with the word Muslims in it at the time was "kill Muslims," and overall, Americans searched for the phrase "kill Muslims" with about the same frequency that they searched for martini recipe, migraine symptoms, and Cowboys roster. In the days following the San Bernardino attack, for every American concerned with Islamophobia, another was searching for "kill Muslims." While hate searches were approximately 20% of all searches about Muslims before the attack, more than half of all search volume about Muslims became hateful in the hours that followed it. And this minute-by-minute search data can tell us how difficult it can be to calm this rage. 4 days after the shooting, then-President Obama gave a primetime address to the country. He both wanted to reassure Americans that the government could stop terrorism and, perhaps more important, quiet this dangerous Islamophobia. Obama appealed to our better angels, speaking of the importance of inclusion and tolerance. The rhetoric was powerful and moving. The Los Angeles Times praised Obama for warning against allowing fear to cloud our judgment. The New York Times called the speech both tough and calming. The website Think Progress praised it as a necessary tool of good governance geared towards saving the lives of Muslim Americans. Obama's speech, in other words, was judged a major success. But was it? Google search data suggests otherwise. Together with Evan Soltis, then at Princeton, I examined the data. In his speech, the president said, "It is the responsibility of all Americans, of every faith, to reject discrimination. But searches calling Muslims terrorists, bad, violent, and evil, doubled during and shortly after the speech." President Obama also said, "It is our responsibility to reject religious tests on who we admit into this country." But negative searches about Syrian refugees, a mostly Muslim group then desperately looking for a safe haven, rose 60%, while searches asking how to help Syrian refugees dropped 35%. Obama asked Americans to not forget that freedom is more powerful than fear, yet searches for kill Muslims tripled during his speech. In fact, just about every negative search we could think to test regarding Muslims shot up during and after Obama's speech, and just about every positive search we could think to test declined. In other words, Obama seemed to say all the right things. All the traditional media congratulated Obama on his healing words. But new data from the internet, offering digital truth serum, suggested that the speech actually backfired in its main goal. Instead of calming the angry mob, as everybody thought he was doing, the internet data tells us that Obama actually inflamed it. Things that we think are working can have the exact opposite effect from the one we expect. Sometimes we need internet data to correct our instinct to pat ourselves on the back. So what should Obama have said to quell this particular form of hatred currently so virulent in America? We'll circle back to that later. Right now, we're going to take a look at an age-old vein of prejudice in the United States, the form of hate that in fact stands out above the rest, the one that has been the most destructive, and the topic of the research that began this audiobook. In my work with Google search data, the single most telling fact I have found regarding hate on the internet is the popularity of the word nigger. Either singular or in its plural form, the word nigger is included in 7 million American searches every year. Again, the word used in rap songs is almost always nigga, not nigger, so there's no significant impact from hip-hop lyrics to account for. Searches for quote-unquote nigger jokes are 17 times more common than searches for kike jokes, gook jokes, spick jokes, chink jokes, and fag jokes combined. When are searches for nigger or niggers or nigger jokes most common? Whenever African Americans are in the news. Among the periods when such searches were highest was the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when television and newspapers showed images of desperate black people in New Orleans struggling for their survival. They also shot up during Obama's first election, and searches for quote-unquote nigger jokes rise on average about 30% on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The frightening ubiquity of this racial slur throws into doubt some current understandings of racism. Any theory of racism has to explain a big puzzle in America. On the one hand, the overwhelming majority of black Americans think they suffer from prejudice, and they have ample evidence of discrimination in police stops, job interviews, and jury decisions. On the other hand, very few white Americans will admit to being racist. The dominant explanation among political scientists recently has been that this is due in large part to widespread implicit prejudice. White Americans may mean well, this theory goes, but they have a subconscious bias which influences their treatment of black Americans. Academics invented an ingenious way to test for such a bias. It is called the implicit association test. The tests have consistently shown that it takes most people milliseconds longer to associate black faces with positive words, such as good, than with negative words, such as awful. For white faces, the pattern is reversed. The extra time it takes is evidence of someone's implicit prejudice, a prejudice the person may not even be aware of. There is, though, an alternative explanation for the discrimination that African Americans feel and whites deny: hidden explicit racism. Suppose there is a reasonably widespread conscious racism of which people are very much aware but to which they won't confess. Certainly not in a survey. That's what the search data seems to be saying. There is nothing implicit about searching for quote-unquote nigger jokes. And it's hard to imagine that Americans are Googling the word nigger with the same frequency as migraine and economist without explicit racism having a major impact on African Americans. Prior to the Google data, we didn't have a convincing measure of this virulent animus. Now we do. We are therefore in a position to see what it explains. It explains, as we discussed earlier, why Obama's vote totals in 2008 and 2012 were depressed in many regions. It also correlates with the black-white wage gap, as a team of economists recently reported. The areas that I had found make the most racist searches, in other words, underpay black people. And then there is the phenomenon of Donald Trump's candidacy. As noted in the introduction, when Nate Silver, the polling guru, looked for the geographic variable that correlated most strongly with support in the 2016 Republican primary for Trump, he found it in the map of racism I had developed. That variable was searches for the word nigger or niggers. Scholars have recently put together a state-by-state measure of implicit prejudice against black people, which has enabled me to compare the effects of explicit racism, as measured by Google searches, and implicit bias. For example, I tested how much each worked against Obama in both of his presidential elections. Using regression analysis, I found that, to predict where Obama underperformed, an area's racist Google searches explained a lot. An area's performance on implicit association tests added little. To be provocative and to encourage more research in this area, let me put forth the following conjecture, ready to be tested by scholars across a range of fields. The primary explanation for discrimination against African Americans today is not the fact that the people who agree to participate in lab experiments make subconscious associations between negative words and black people. It is the fact that millions of white Americans continue to do things like search for quote-unquote nigger jokes. The discrimination black people regularly experience in the United States appears to be fueled more widely by explicit, if hidden, hostility, but, for other groups, subconscious prejudice may have a more fundamental impact. For example, I was able to use Google searches to find evidence of implicit prejudice against another segment of the population, young girls. And who, might you ask, would be harboring bias against girls? Their parents. It's hardly surprising that parents of young children are often excited by the thought that their kids might be gifted. In fact, of all Google searches starting, "Is my 2-year-old," the most common next word is gifted. But this question is not asked equally about young boys and young girls. Parents are 2.5 times more likely to ask, "Is my son gifted?" than "Is my daughter gifted?" Parents show a similar bias when using other phrases related to intelligence that they may shy away from saying aloud, like, "Is my son a genius?" Are parents picking up on legitimate differences between young girls and boys? Perhaps young boys are more likely than young girls to use big words or otherwise show objective signs of giftedness. Nope. If anything, it's the opposite. At young ages, girls have consistently been shown to have larger vocabularies and use more complex sentences. In American schools, girls are 9% more likely than boys to be in gifted programs. Despite all this, parents looking around the dinner table appear to see more gifted boys than girls. To further test the hypothesis that parents treat kids of different genders differently, I am working on obtaining data from parenting websites. This would include a much larger number of parents than those who make these particular specific searches. In fact, on every search term related to intelligence I tested, including those indicating its absence, parents were more likely to be inquiring about their sons rather than their daughters. There are also more searches for "Is my son behind?" or "stupid?" than comparable searches for daughters. But searches with negative words like "behind" and "stupid" are less specifically skewed towards sons than searches with positive words such as "gifted" or "genius." What then are parents' overriding concerns regarding their daughters? Primarily anything related to appearance. Consider questions about a child's weight. Parents Google, "Is my daughter overweight?" roughly twice as frequently as they Google, "Is my son overweight?" Parents are about twice as likely to ask, how to get their daughters to lose weight as they are to ask how to get their sons to do the same. Just as with giftedness, this gender bias is not grounded in reality. About 28% of girls are overweight, while 35% of boys are. Even though scales measure more overweight boys than girls, parents see or worry about overweight girls much more frequently than overweight boys. Parents are also 1.5 times more likely to ask whether their daughter is beautiful than whether their son is handsome, and they are nearly 3 times more likely to ask whether their daughter is ugly than whether their son is ugly. How Google is expected to know whether a child is beautiful or ugly is hard to say. In general, parents seem more likely to use positive words in questions about sons. They are more apt to ask whether a son is happy and less apt to ask whether a son is depressed. Liberal listeners may imagine that these biases are more common in conservative parts of the country, but I didn't find any evidence of that. In fact, I didn't find a significant relationship between any of these biases and the political or cultural makeup of a state. Nor is there evidence that these biases have decreased since 2004, the year for which Google search data is first available. It would seem this bias against girls is more widespread and deeply ingrained than we'd care to believe. Sexism is not the only place our stereotypes about prejudice may be off. Viking Maiden 88 is 26 years old. She enjoys reading history and writing poetry. Her signature quote is from Shakespeare. I gleaned all this from her profile and posts on Stormfront.org, America's most popular online hate site. I also learned that Viking Maiden 88 had enjoyed the content on the site of the newspaper I work for, the New York Times. She wrote an enthusiastic post about a particular Times feature. I recently analyzed tens of thousands of such Stormfront profiles in which registered members can enter their location, birth date, interests, and other information. Stormfront was founded in 1995 by Don Black, a former Ku Klux Klan leader. Its most popular quote-unquote social groups are Union of National Socialists and Fans and Supporters of Adolf Hitler. Over the past year, according to QuantCast, roughly 200,000 to 400,000 Americans visited the site every month. A recent Southern Poverty Law Center report linked nearly 100 murders in the past 5 years to registered Stormfront members. Stormfront members are not whom I would have guessed. They tend to be young, at least according to self-reported birth dates. The most common age at which people join the site is 19, and 4 times more 19-year-olds sign up than 40-year-olds. Internet and social network users lean young, but not nearly that young. Profiles do not have a field for gender, but I looked at all the posts and complete profiles of a random sample of American users, and it turns out that you can work out the gender of most of the membership. I estimate that about 30% of Stormfront members are female. The states with the most members per capita are Montana, Alaska, and Idaho. These states tend to be overwhelmingly white. Does this mean that growing up with little diversity fosters hate? Probably not. Rather, since those states have a higher proportion of non-Jewish white people, they have more potential members for a group that attacks Jews and non-whites. The percentage of Stormfront's target audience that joins is actually higher in areas with more minorities. This is particularly true when you look at Stormfront's members who are 18 and younger, and therefore do not themselves choose where they live. Among this age group, California, a state with one of the largest minority populations, has a membership rate 25% higher than the national average. One of the most popular social groups on the site is In Support of Anti-Semitism. The percentage of members who join this group is positively correlated with the state's Jewish population. New York, the state with the highest Jewish population, has above average per capita membership in this group. In 2001, DNA 88 joined Stormfront, describing himself as a good-looking, racially aware, 30-year-old internet developer living in New York City. In the next 4 months, he wrote more than 200 posts like Jewish Crimes Against Humanity and Jewish blood money and directed people to a website, JewWatch.com, which claims to be a scholarly library on Zionist criminality. Stormfront members complain about minorities speaking different languages and committing crimes, but what I found most interesting were the complaints about competition in the dating market. A man calling himself William Lyon Mackenzie King, after a former Prime Minister of Canada who once suggested that Canada should remain a white man's country, wrote in 2003 that he struggled to contain his rage after seeing a white woman carrying around her half-black, ugly, mongrel niglet. In her profile, White Pride 26, a 41-year-old student in Los Angeles says, "I dislike blacks, Latinos, and sometimes Asians, especially when men find them more attractive than a white female." Certain political developments play a role. The day that saw the biggest single increase in membership in Stormfront's history by far was November 5th, 2008, the day after Barack Obama was elected president. There was, however, no increased interest in Stormfront during Donald Trump's candidacy, and only a small rise immediately after he won. Trump rode a wave of white nationalism. There is no evidence here that he created a wave of white nationalism. Obama's election led to a surge in the white nationalist movement. Trump's election seems to be a response to that. One thing that does not seem to matter? Economics. There was no relationship between monthly membership registration and a state's unemployment rate. States disproportionately affected by the Great Recession saw no comparative increase in Google searches for Stormfront. But perhaps what was most interesting and surprising were some of the topics of conversation Stormfront members have. They are similar to those my friends and I talk about. Maybe it was my own naivete, but I would have imagined white nationalists inhabiting a different universe from that of my friends and me. Instead, they have long threads praising Game of Thrones and discussing the comparative merits of online dating sites like Plenty of Fish and OkCupid. And the key fact that shows that Stormfront users are inhabiting similar universes as people like me and my friends, the popularity of the New York Times among Stormfront users. It isn't just Viking Maiden 88 hanging around the Times site. The site is popular among many of its members. In fact, when you compare Stormfront users to people who visit the Yahoo News site, it turns out that the Stormfront crowd is twice as likely to visit nytimes.com. Members of a hate site perusing the oh-so-liberal nytimes.com? How could this possibly be? If a substantial number of Stormfront members get their news from nytimes.com, it means our conventional wisdom about white nationalists is wrong. It also means our conventional wisdom about how the internet works is wrong. The truth about the internet. The internet, most everybody agrees, is driving Americans apart, causing most people to hole up in sites geared toward people like them. Here's how Cass Sunstein of Harvard Law School described the situation. "Our communications market is rapidly moving toward a situation where people restrict themselves to their own points of view. Liberals watching and reading mostly or only liberals, moderates, moderates, conservatives, conservatives, neo-Nazis, neo-Nazis." This view makes sense. After all, the internet gives us a virtually unlimited number of options from which we can consume the news. I can read whatever I want. You can read whatever you want. Viking Maiden 88 can read whatever she wants. And people, if left to their own devices, tend to seek out viewpoints that confirm what they believe. Thus, surely the internet must be creating extreme political segregation. There is one problem with this standard view. The data tells us that it is simply not true. The evidence against this piece of conventional wisdom comes from a 2011 study by Matt Jenskow and Jesse Shapiro, two economists whose work we discussed earlier. Jenskow and Shapiro collected data on the browsing behavior of a large sample of Americans. Their data set also included the ideology, self-reported, of their subjects, whether people considered themselves more liberal or conservative. They used this data to measure the political segregation on the internet. How? they performed an interesting thought experiment. Suppose you randomly sampled two Americans who happen to both be visiting the same news website. What is the probability one of them will be liberal and the other conservative? How frequently, in other words, do liberals and conservatives meet on news sites? To think about this further, suppose liberals and conservatives on the internet never got their online news from the same place. In other words, liberals exclusively visited liberal websites, conservatives exclusively conservative ones. If this were the case, the chances that two Americans on a given news site have opposing political views would be 0%. The internet would be perfectly segregated. Liberals and conservatives would never mix. Suppose, in contrast, that liberals and conservatives did not differ at all in how they got their news. In other words, a liberal and a conservative were equally likely to visit any particular news site. If this were the case, the chances that two Americans on a given news website have opposing political views would be roughly 50%. The internet would be perfectly desegregated. Liberals and conservatives would perfectly mix. So what does the data tell us? In the United States, according to Jenskow and Shapiro, the chances that two people visiting the same news site have different political views is about 45%. In other words, the internet is far closer to perfect desegregation than perfect segregation. Liberals and conservatives are quote-unquote meeting each other on the web all the time. What really puts the lack of segregation on the internet in perspective is comparing it to segregation in other parts of our lives. Jenskow and Shapiro could repeat their analysis for various offline interactions. What are the chances that two family members have different political views? Two neighbors, two colleagues, two friends. Using data from the General Social Survey, Jenskow and Shapiro found that all these numbers were lower than the chances that two people on the same news website have different politics. The data is reproduced on the enhancement. Probability that someone you meet has opposing political views. On a news website, 45.2%. Coworker, 41.6%. Offline neighbor, 40.3%. Family member, 37%. Friend, 34.7%. In other words, you're more likely to come across someone with opposing views online than you are offline. Why isn't the internet more segregated? There are two factors that limit political segregation on the internet. First, somewhat surprisingly, the internet news industry is dominated by a few massive sites. We usually think of the internet as appealing to the fringes. Indeed, there are sites for everybody, no matter your viewpoints. There are landing spots for pro-gun and anti-gun crusaders, cigar rights and dollar coin activists, anarchists and white nationalists. But these sites together account for a small fraction of the internet's news traffic. In fact, in 2009, four sites, Yahoo News, AOL News, MSNBC.com, and CNN.com, collected more than half of news views. Yahoo News remains the most popular news site among Americans, with close to 90 million unique monthly visitors, or some 600 times Stormfront's audience. Mass media sites like Yahoo News appeal to a broad, politically diverse audience. The second reason the internet isn't all that segregated is that many people with strong political opinions visit sites of the opposite viewpoint, if only to get angry and argue. Political junkies do not limit themselves only to sites geared toward them. Someone who visits thinkprogress.org and moveon.org, two extremely liberal sites, is more likely than the average internet user to visit foxnews.com, a right-leaning site. Someone who visits rushlimbaugh.com or glennbeck.com, two extremely conservative sites, is more likely than the average internet user to visit nytimes.com, a more liberal site. Jenskow and Shapiro's study was based on data from 2004 to 2009, relatively early in the history of the internet. Might the internet have grown more compartmentalized since then? Have social media, and in particular Facebook, altered their conclusion? Clearly, if our friends tend to share our political views, the rise of social media should mean a rise of echo chambers. right? Again, the story is not so simple. While it is true that people's friends on Facebook are more likely than not to share their political views, a team of data scientists, Aitan Bakshi, Solomon Messing, and Leda Adamek, have found that a surprising amount of the information people get on Facebook comes from people with opposing views. How can this be? Don't our friends tend to share our political views? Indeed they do, but there is one crucial reason that Facebook may lead to a more diverse political discussion than offline socializing. People on average have substantially more friends on Facebook than they do offline, and these weak ties facilitated by Facebook are more likely to be people with opposite political views. In other words, Facebook exposes us to weak social connections, the high school acquaintance, the crazy third cousin, the friend of the friend of the friend you sort of, kind of, maybe know. These are people you might never go bowling with or to a barbecue with. You might not invite them over to a dinner party, but you do Facebook friend them, and you do see their links to articles with views you might have never otherwise considered. In sum, the internet actually brings people of different political views together. The average liberal may spend her morning with her liberal husband and liberal kids, her afternoon with her liberal co-workers, her commute surrounded by liberal bumper stickers, her evening with her liberal yoga classmates. When she comes home and peruses a few conservative comments on CNN.com or gets a Facebook link from her Republican high school acquaintance, this may be her highest conservative exposure of the day. I probably never encounter white nationalists in my favorite coffee shop in Brooklyn, but Viking Maiden 88 and I both frequent the New York Times site. The truth about child abuse and abortion. The internet can give us insights into not just disturbing attitudes, but also disturbing behaviors. Indeed, Google data may be effective at alerting us to crises that are missed by all the usual sources. People, after all, turn to Google when they are in trouble. Consider child abuse during the Great Recession. When this major economic downturn started in late 2007, many experts were naturally worried about the effect it might have on children. After all, many parents would be stressed and depressed, and these are major risk factors for maltreatment. Child abuse might skyrocket. Then the official data came in, and it seemed that the worry was unfounded. Child Protective Service agencies reported that they were getting fewer cases of abuse. Further, these drops were largest in states that were hardest hit by the recession. The doom and gloom predictions haven't come true, Richard Gels, a child welfare expert at the University of Pennsylvania, told the Associated Press in 2011. Yes, as counterintuitive as it may have seemed, child abuse seemed to have plummeted during the recession. But did child abuse really drop with so many adults out of work and extremely distressed? I had trouble believing this, so I turned to Google data. It turns out some kids make some tragic and heart-wrenching searches on Google, such as, "My mom beat me," or "My dad hit me." And these searches present a different and agonizing picture of what happened during this time. The number of searches like this shot up during the Great Recession, closely tracking the unemployment rate. Here's what I think happened. It was the reporting of child abuse cases that declined, not the child abuse itself. After all, it is estimated that only a small percentage of child abuse cases are reported to authorities anyway, and during a recession, many of the people who tend to report child abuse cases, teachers and police officers, for example, and handle cases, child protective service workers, are more likely to be overworked or out of work. There were many stories during the economic downturn of people trying to report potential cases facing long wait times and giving up. Indeed, there is more evidence, this time not from Google, that child abuse actually rose during the recession. When a child dies due to abuse or neglect, it has to be reported. Such deaths, although rare, did rise in states that were hardest hit by the recession. And there is some evidence from Google that more people were suspecting abuse in hard-hit areas. Controlling for pre-recession rates and national trends, states that had comparatively suffered the most had increased search rates for child abuse and neglect. For every percentage point increase in the unemployment rate, there was an associated 3% increase in the search rate for child abuse or child neglect. Presumably, most of these people never successfully reported the abuse, as these states had the biggest drops in the reporting.